I do not know a business that could take a 95% cut and continue to operate.
Congress begins the delicate process of legislating fish policy. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 20th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, the science of massive underwater waves.
We expect that the larger fjords, such as Prince William Sound, would be absolutely filled with these things.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The U.S. House began a debate on a bill by Alaska Congressman Don Young this evening to renew the Magnuson-Stevens Act, the nation's primary fishing law. Actually, lawmakers just debated how they're going to debate the legislation. Meanwhile, the White House has issued a policy statement criticizing Young's bill, suggesting the president would veto it. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
The White House, like environmental groups and some small boat fishermen, disapproves of the flexibility written into Young's bill. It would give regional management councils more leeway to set catch limits and rebuild stocks. The White House says Young's flexible approach would put fish stocks at risk. Young spokesman Matthew Shukro says the congressman is still listening to stakeholders, and he says the bill is likely to change in the legislative process ahead.
We believe, and Congressman Young believes, that it's entirely premature for the president to discuss vetoing the legislation at this time.
Young says some regions of the country don't have enough fish data to employ the rigid, science-based model that's been so successful in the North Pacific. Critics, though, say if catch limits aren't tied to science, councils will be pressured to let fishermen take too much, depleting the resource. That very debate played out on the other side of the Capitol today in a Senate subcommittee hearing on fisheries data. Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire made a passionate plea for the cod fishermen of New England. Their catch limit, the senator says, was slashed 75% in a single year.
And then when I look back over the course of 5 years, the total cut is 95%. I do not know a business that could take a 95% cut and continue to operate.
Catherine Sullivan, the head of NOAA, told Ayotte she does care about fishermen, but she says the cod of New England are in dire trouble, in danger of never recovering.
We are obliged by law to set catch limits that ensure we do not have overfishing occurring on a stock, and with a stock that's at just 3% of its biomass, that is a disastrously low number.
And here's the problem. You're also obliged by law to think about the economic impact.
Ayotte says fishermen have no confidence in NOAA's grim stock assessment because it doesn't match what they're seeing on the water. The NOAA administrator told her there's a place for fishermen's observations, but
cod are known to school in very large aggregations. And when they aggregate that way, it becomes easier to catch the fish, and that can give sometimes a false impression, sometimes a false impression.
So I don't want to interrupt you because I know my...
A Senate bill to renew the Magnuson-Stevens Act hasn't emerged yet. The full House is expected to begin debate on Young's version of the bill June 1st when it returns from the Memorial Day recess. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Anyone who has spent time on a beach can visualize rolling waves breaking as they approach the shoreline. What most probably don't realize is the same thing happens out of sight, deep under the ocean surface, but on a massive scale. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Picture this, a giant wave close to 1,000 feet tall spanning more than 50 miles. That's the scale we're talking about, and it's happening thousands of feet underwater. Harper Simmons is an associate professor of oceanography at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He's been studying these massive undersea waves for over a decade.
If you've ever seen the office toys that have a layer of blue fluid and a layer of clear fluid, and you can rock them back and forth and see these very slow-moving undulations, that is exactly the phenomena that we are talking about.
Since 2007, Simmons has been taking part in a study in the South China Sea with researchers from 25 institutions from 5 countries, taking a closer look at how these waves work. Even though the movement of these waves appears similar to waves on the surface, he says there are some differences.
They move at approximately 3 meters per second, whereas a surface wave might move at, 10 or 20 times that rate. So they're massive waves. They contain huge amounts of energy, but they evolve in slow motion relative to what we would see at the surface.
But why are these waves so important? Big waves create big turbulence, and Simmons says that's what makes them vital.
And anywhere you can have strong turbulence, you can bring up fresh nutrients from depth. And so these waves have profound effects on ecosystems.
By redistributing the deep sea nutrients closer to the surface, the waves help replenish the shallower parts of the ocean where much of the biological activity takes place. Undersea waves require ocean stratification in order to form, meaning layers of water defined by differences in salinity and temperature. If stratification exists, Simmons says the other primary ingredient is usually tidal action, moving over submarine ridges, islands, and other types of underwater topography, which means these waves are forming all over the world, including Alaska.
In a place like Prince William Sound, a fjord is highly stratified, and there's very significant tides. So we expect that the larger fjords, such as Prince William Sound, would be absolutely filled with these things.
Not much research has been done on Alaska's subsurface waves, but Simmons says researchers do know they form in the Arctic Ocean, albeit in a weaker form.
One of the main energy sources for these are from storms in the Arctic, and the ice is a kind of an insulating barrier to prevent that kind of energy from being put into the ocean.
Simmons says researchers are interested to see if the Arctic dynamic changes as the area continues seeing reduced sea ice seasonally. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
The ocean-driven climate cycle El Niño is back. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, that means immediate weather changes along the equator. But Alaska is also likely to see some effects.
Elevated sea surface temperatures in the equatorial Pacific, characteristic of El Niño, have been present for months. But National Weather Service Climate Science and Services Manager Rick Toman says until recently there's been no link to the atmosphere.
That's what's changed. The atmosphere is now starting to respond in a more typical El Niño fashion.
Toman says that means consistent deep tropical thunderstorm activity along the equator from southwest of Hawaii east to South America. But he adds summer impacts to North America are generally not very strong.
It's really when we start to get into the autumn that big tropical thunderstorms can start to affect the jet stream flow and potentially affect our weather.
That said, Toman expects El Niño will extend already warmer than normal sea temperatures along the west coast in Alaska. As far as likely weather impacts in the state next winter, Toman points to general trends.
El Niño winters for Alaska tend to be relatively mild. Precipitation tends to be above normal along the Gulf Coast, but the interior tends to tilt dry.
Toman adds that the impact of El Niño hinges on its strength, something meteorologists don't have a handle on yet. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, documenting the intimate details of Anchorage's Chester Creek Trail through art.
Well, there's a red fox that lives over here, and I've seen him or her many, many times over the years, mostly in winter.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo. Together, we'll go far. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
A young woman who traveled to the remote Bering Strait Island community of Little Diomede to speak at the school's graduation was found dead at the community school. Alaska State Troopers say 33-year-old Nome resident Evita Samuels was found unresponsive in the school's library early Tuesday morning by a school employee. Investigators say foul play is not suspected, and the woman was experiencing unknown medical issues in the days before her death. Bering Strait School District Superintendent Bobby Bolin says Samuels was invited by the Diomede School's senior class to speak at their May 8th graduation. She was supposed to leave the island May 11th. The only flight on or off the island, a helicopter service provided by Portland-based Ericsson Aviation, has been hampered by technical and weather delays since May 7th. A group of Juneau residents have been trying to remove a transitional home for just-released female inmates from their neighborhood for over a year. After exhausting all municipal appeal options, the Neighborhood Association is taking the fight to court. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Haven House can continue operating on Melissa Drive in the Mendenhall Valley for now. The Juneau Assembly denied the Tall Timbers Neighborhood Association's appeal Monday, upholding the Planning Commission's decision to allow permitting for Haven House. Attorney Dan Bruce represents the Neighborhood Association.
My clients intend to appeal that decision to the Superior Court.
He wants the state court to overturn the city's decision. Bruce and his clients continue to argue that Haven House is a halfway house, which, under city code, isn't allowed in typical residential districts like the area around Melissa Drive.
Haven House is the only non-single-family use in that whole neighborhood.
Bruce says the home will have an adverse effect on the neighborhood and lower property values. He hopes the legal fight will shut the house down. Haven House Director Kara Nelson says she isn't surprised. In the beginning of the Tall Timbers protest, she says she took it personally. Nelson herself has been in prison and struggled with addiction. She's been sober since 2011. Now she sees the fight as an opportunity.
It really brings a good challenge for those of us that have been in prison to really show what we know, and that is what we're being perceived as is not true when we're living in long-term recovery.
Haven House is a faith-based nonprofit. It provides a structured living situation where residents have to come up with an individual action plan and get the support to follow it through. They must attend some sort of women's support, recovery, or Bible group. Haven House can accept up to 9 women transitioning out of prison who can live there for up to 2 years. Nelson says the Tall Timbers' perception of what Haven House will do to the neighborhood is an example of the stigma Haven House residents face on a daily basis.
We're not going to be ashamed. We're not dismissing the crimes that have been committed. But what we're saying is addiction is a disease. And so we're focusing on the solution. The solution is long-term recovery. And to do that, you surround yourself with other people who have done it before you.
Nelson says it's been a long journey to get Haven House going. And she says an appeal at the Superior Court level is just another step. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
This season's first batch of salmon fry will soon be entering the open ocean with lots of food and plenty of predators. Some will be back in a few years to spawn. But fisheries biologists wonder about one salmon run that left a Juneau stream earlier than ever. They're curious about how a new large mass of warm ocean water will affect those young salmon as they grow. KTOO's Matt Miller has the story.
And it's good to separate them because the little fish don't like being in with the big fish.
John Joyce just counted one more pink salmon passing through the weir at Auk Creek, north of downtown Juneau. The tiny inch-long fry is a straggler. Most of his 14,000 siblings are already hanging out in Auk Bay before heading to the open ocean.
There's physical characteristics on the shape of their fins and the shape of their eyes and their coloration. You have the ability to tell them apart, but it does take some time to get your your eye educated, because we do rely on that to separate out the species.
Joyce is a fisheries research biologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He says this year's outmigration of pink fry from Ock Creek is one of the lowest on record and 2 weeks ahead of schedule. That's based on data collected over 35 years. Joyce suspects the recent mild winters prompted by climate change are behind the subtle yet steady trend, but he's not so sure about another relatively new phenomenon.
But you're not willing to say that the blob was the cause of it?
No. It's the blob.
That's the name coined by Washington State climatologist Nicholas Bond for a huge, evolving, moving mass of warm ocean water in the eastern North Pacific.
We do know that in 2014, because of that warm water, that the base of the food web, production of phytoplankton that supports the whole food web, was reduced because that warm water served to kind of isolate the near-surface waters from the more nutrient-rich water below.
Bond says the blob is bad news for lower 48 salmon since the warmer water attracts less nutritious prey species. He says they're not quite sure how it will affect Alaska salmon. Over the last two winters, the blob has moved and stretched out along the coast of western U.S. from the Gulf of Alaska all the way down to Baja California. That's right in the path of pink salmon coming home this year. How will they be affected? And for the answer, Joyce refers to a prognosticating colleague at NOAA's Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute.
Joe Stradamus.
Fisheries biologist Joe Orsi says they're cautiously optimistic about a strong run of about 55 million fish this year. Those pinks will be the children of 2013's big return. But they'll be running through the blob as they approach the Oregon shore and start heading north.
The implications of climate change on fish species is important for them all, and salmon are actually going to be the first ones reporting back to us if there's a problem out there. And we'll know this year if the warm blob of 2014 caused something terrible to happen to the pink salmon, because they're just basically not going to return in high numbers this year.
Orsi also wonders about those Ock Creek pink fry heading out early this spring. He uses the term
mismatch
to describe how the out-of-sync fry may wander around and wait for their zooplankton breakfast to show up.
If they can't grow, they spend more time in the nearshore, the littoral zone near the beach when they're small, and they're more vulnerable to predators, you know, both avian and fish predators, because they need to grow to a certain size before they actually start moving offshore and migrating out into the open waters.
And how will the blob affect those out-migrating, still-developing pink salmon? Orsi says the salmon will grow faster in slightly warmer water, but they'll also need more food. And the warmer water could attract other unusual species and potential predators like blue shark and thresher shark and Humboldt squid. Back at the Ock Creek Weir, John Joyce says they won't be getting any quick and easy answers about the effects of the blob. They'll also have to consider other ecosystem factors.
It's all very interesting in terms of how these populations can optimize their productivity over time and, you know, be successful and continue to deal with, you know, some changing environmental conditions. They have the ability to adapt and to change their behavior, but at what point is it too much or, you know, too little?
There may be a few clues when the first pinks return from the 2013 brood year. That's coming up in August. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
A legendary Western Alaska salvage vessel has reached the end of its life. Salvager Dan Magone is ready to sink his old tugboat, the Redeemer. And as KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, it means he's also getting ready for the next phase of his own storied career.
These days, even getting onto the Redeemer is a bit of an adventure. The tug is separated from the dock in Dutch Harbor by two other Dan McGowan projects, old vessels in disrepair.
So, I guess the only place to cross is right here.
McGowan is finding a tricky path out to the boat where he built his career. The Redeemer had its last mission in 2013, when the crab boat Arctic Hunter went aground outside on Alaska. Now the tug is past its prime. It's littered with remnants of old jobs, wood pallets, rusty scrap metal, an old National Geographic in the wheelhouse, all waiting for a proper send-off.
I spent a lot of the last 25 years on this boat. Lots of days and nights, lots of adventures.
The Redeemer was built in World War II and then became an oil drilling mud ship off the Gulf Coast. In the 1980s, McGowan says a company heading to the Nome gold fields took it on. They wrecked it on the sand dunes there, and it stayed put for almost a decade.
During that time, I saw it over there, and people suggested it'd make a great boat for me, and I told them no, it would probably cost me $100,000 to get it off the sand dunes and get it to Dutch.
Instead, he says the boat wound up with loggers from Sitka. They patched it up and headed south, but wound up abandoning the ship in Sand Point.
And then it sank at the dock. And so everywhere it goes, it's leaving people with their head in their hands, right?
Meanwhile, McGowan had just paid millions to set up his floating Dutch Harbor office and was losing local business to shorter fishing seasons. He saw a new opportunity in the stranded boat. He rebuilt it for cheap with scraps from his own yard. The yellow-green hull was painted a bright blue, and McGowan renamed the boat Redeemer. He says its first job was hauling horses, dogs, hay, and cowboys to the other side of Unalaska Island to start the Chernofsky Cattle Ranch.
And so we did all manner of anything all over the Bering Sea and the Aleutian Islands, Alaska Peninsula, and we managed to survive. We managed to find enough work to keep going.
Over the next two decades, he says the Redeemer was part of
almost every significant salvage job in Western Alaska.
From the small, like stranded barges and fishing boats, to the huge, deadly groundings and oil spills on the Kuroshima and Salandang cargo ships, and the capsizing of the Cougar Ace. All those accidents, plus the Exxon Valdez spill, helped usher in new environmental protection and safety standards. By 2013, McGowan says the Redeemer couldn't keep up, and work on its replacement was just as pricey.
It eventually cost so much that I just had to sell the company.
That sale to Resolve Marine International went through last year, and the Redeemer has been taking up valuable space in their new shop. Shipping it out as scrap isn't cost-effective, so McGowan is asking the federal government for permission to scuttle the boat. Back on its deck, he says that'll mean cleaning it out, setting up explosives, and sinking it at a mile-deep spot north of Unalaska Island. He's been allowed to sink ships there in the past.
See, all this equipment, the winches and the cranes, all the hydraulic lines and stuff, that all comes off. There can't be any loose debris in or on the boat.
Increasing regulations have made scuttling harder, too, but McGowan is confident this one will happen in the next couple of months. He's already taken the ship's bell from the wheelhouse.
Otherwise, it's just something, just another piece of metal, might be worth something to somebody, you know. But that one's, I don't want to sell.
His new work boat, the McCushion Bay, is visible outside the window, built for the future, but the same blue as the Redeemer. McGowan says it marks the start of a new era, and the Redeemer's scuttling will be the end of another.
The old days, the seat of your pants, you know, just go out and get her done type of thing, those days are gone, you know, with all the regulations and oversight. And it's not the world that we were able to operate in. That world is past now.
The world where McGowan was a cowboy too, like the ones he once took for a ride on the Redeemer. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
People traveling on the Chester Creek Trail in Midtown Anchorage this week might notice a group wandering about in Kelly Green vests and sashes adorned with a distinctive merit badge. They aren't overgrown Girl Scouts. They're artists who are seeking the source of the trail and its role in the community.
Well, I don't have an opening line.
Anchorage photographer Michael Conti strolls down the Chester Creek Trail, clutching his camera and smiling beneath his wide-brimmed hat. He's looking for people to photograph and trying to figure out how to explain to them why he's doing it.
I would say, well, we're trying to make art about this trail, on the trail and with the users of the trail and with the in the landscape of the trail. And what else would I say to a person? I don't know. I'd probably leave it there, because the more I talk, the more confused I get about this project.
Conti is one of eight artists participating in a nebulous thing called Seeking the Source. The group also includes artists who are sketching the plants that grow in the area, writers who are looking for intimate spaces, even a stilt walker who's recording stories from passersby about the trail. They're meeting with groups and walking the trail for a week to interact with random individuals. Jimmy Rorden is the mastermind behind it. He says he wants people to engage in the space in a new way, notice things that they might ignore when traveling on a trail they've visited 100 times before.
The arts are a place where it's okay to have conversations about things that maybe wouldn't come up in other forms or in other situations.
He says the group is leading an expedition to discover the stories, sounds, and experiences of what the trail is today. So before they set off, they consulted a map, or rather a room full of maps and historical documents at the city's Parks and Rec Department.
Let's guess the decade based on the color choice.
Definitely 70.
Well, the color might be.
The Muni started buying land for the Greenbelt in 1965, well before it was a popular thing to do. The current trail runs about 4 miles and started as a footpath. The city owns more land along the creek, but hasn't been able to develop it yet.
Dear Mr. Pitchford, it has come to our attention that a garden plot at your residence is not properly located on your property, but is encroaching on the Chester Creek Greenbelt Park property.
That's artist Aidan LaRue reading a letter from 1982. Manila folders stuffed with documents show everything from property lines and drainage ditches to outdated, underfunded project proposals. Some plans for the area say the creek cannot be rehabilitated. Others highlight its potential. Rorden walks through the tunnel that runs under Minnesota Drive. He says opinions and experiences on the trail still vary from person to person. Planning this project changed his relationship with the area.
Maybe it's a different sort of intimacy or a different sort of knowledge. Because I agree, I used to commute on the trail, and I definitely knew when you think about things like bumps or different neighborhoods. And I don't think I noticed exactly where the line from like one type of landscape shifted to the next.
He says those are the personal experiences he and his team are collecting for their website. Photographer Conti is already hard at work on his map of Westchester Lagoon. It's sketched with childlike symbols inside a 30-year-old book of hexagonal graphing paper left over from his teenaged role-playing days. It includes the usual landmarks and some less typical stuff.
Well, there's a red fox that lives over here, and I've seen him or her many, many times over the years, mostly in winter. So, and there's salmon over here, and there's cranes over here, and there's a tugboat pulling a barge, and a broken bridge.
Conti's starting to get the idea of what they're trying to do. He's thinking about what the trail he's walked on for more than a decade really means to him. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Josh Edge in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Matthew Smith in Nome, Lisa Fu and Matt Miller in Juneau, and Annie Ropeek in Unalaska. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web producer, and I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.